The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true. But shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
Now, Wesley, you know I'm someone who doesn't really believe in spoilers.
I just don't understand it, but it's a thing I've learned to love about you, yes.
You know, this is a controversial take. This is a controversial opinion. For most things, it just doesn't really bother me if I know the outcome. It does not take away from my enjoyment. Mm-hmm. That said, there are some exceptions to this rule. Survivor and Drag Race. I don't want any GD spoilers. So
all right.
This is all a run-up, all a preface to say that we're going to do something we both deeply love to do on this podcast, which is dive so deep on a movie that we will have to spoil it. And that movie is the Oscar sugar baby, Promising Young Woman, written and directed by Emerald Fennell.
Yes, it is nominated for several Academy Awards, including Best Director, Best Picture, Best Actress for Carey Mulligan, who plays the Promising Young Woman of the title, one of the Promising Young Women of the title.
And you and I cannot stop talking to each other about this movie, which is such a signal for us that we got to work it out in the room.
Yes.
So, you know, just a heads up. Look, this movie is dark. This movie is violent. It includes sexual violence. That's our warning. You've been warned. But we hope you'll join us anyway, because it's going to be a really good conversation.
Yeah, you also do not have to have seen this movie to listen to it. We will be,
exactly.
We might even be having this conversation in lieu of your seeing the movie. I recommend you watch it because I think it's worth watching, but we're not going to spoil the movie. We're going to enhance
yes.
the viewing experience of it.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
I'm Wesley Morris.
I'm Jenna Wortham.
We are two culture writers for the New York Times.
And this is Still Processing. The beginning of the movie, a bunch of scumbag dudes hanging out at a bar talking about scamming on girls.
Class out to a strip club,
which we can't even do anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, what you're basically seeing is these, you know, suit guys. They're like consultants or, you know, middle manager, young middle manager types. And they spy, like, on the other side of this bar, this woman sort of sprawled out on a banquette. And she looks really in trouble.
Right.
Her legs are kind of spread open a little bit.
Her eyes are closed.
Yes, this woman is played by Carey Mulligan. She's just so out of it. She's drunk or something.
And she's slumping over. She's having a hard time staying upright. And these men who are essentially portrayed as a pack of sharks start figuring out who's going to be the one to try to take her home.
I'll go over.
And so Adam Brody's character says, I'm just going to go check on her.
I didn't know you
had to see if she's okay.
Yeah, no, of course.
It just brings up all these memories of moments when we've made not great decisions about our own consumption and overconsumption. So I feel my stomach nodding up when I'm watching this scene in uncomfortable memories.
I mean, he's asking if it's okay for her to go back to his house for another drink.
Yeah.
Like, she's already really hammered.
Do you live alone here?
No, but my roommate's out of town, so don't worry.
He's kissing her. Yeah. Her mouth isn't doing anything. His mouth is doing everything, and her mouth is not moving at all.
Right, so what we're watching is someone really press up on the fringes of consent. She's there. She's not really awake. She's not really upright. And this guy is totally taking advantage of the situation. And it feels really gross to watch.
Oh. Yeah, so now they're on his bed. And now he's trying to undress her?
He's undressing her.
Don't go to sleep.
What? He's pulled down her underwear.
Gosh, you're so pretty.
And he's between her legs.
This is one of the most uncomfortable scenes in the movie.
What are you doing?
Wait. And now the music heightens up her eyes open wide, clear as day. Homegirl is so burr, it turns out. She sits up, looks him dead in the face, and says,
"Hey, I said, what are you doing?"
Her clear-eyed sobriety is the scariest thing in the world to this man, and he looks up in horror. He's like, "What?" And then we get to the title cards.
That is our opening salvo in this movie.
Right.
And she goes home, she pulls out a notebook, and it's filled with hundreds of tally marks. And so you realize Adam Brody in this first scene is just the, like, the umpteenth dude she has pulled this move on.
Yes. We realize that everything we've thought about her, all of our initial impressions of her, need to be reevaluated.
You also understand that there is something just off about what we're watching. This is this character's entire life. Targeting guys and obsessively marking them down. And you want to know where it's going to go next.
You know, I love the scene where you see the notebook because she's in this, you know, traditional girly bedroom.
Her girlhood bedroom.
Yeah, what appears to be her girlhood bedroom. It just becomes very evident and clear that Cassie's plan to keep teaching these men a lesson, and I guess shocking them into sobriety, is the only thing she cares about. And I really love the subversiveness of the shot. You know, I love movies that tell you from the jump exactly what they're going to be about. And this movie is No Country for Any Men. Like, there's just no redemption, like, hashtag all men. You know, there's a hashtag that's like, not all men to be redemptive, and like, not all men are sexists and rapists and et cetera, et cetera. And this movie asks the question, well, what if all men? What if the world Cassie lives in, there are no good men?
Yeah. I feel like this works as a fairy tale. And we're in like a kind of once upon a time realm. And within that fairy tale is this morality question about men and their behavior. And it's a thriller, as we're going to discover, with an actual thriller plot.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to it being a fairy tale, a morality play, and a thriller, it is also just a romantic comedy from like 1999 or 2004. Yeah. And Cassie works in a coffee shop with her best pal, who's played by Laverne Cox, and her boss, by the way. And in walks one day a person who recognizes Cassie.
So in walks this dude named Ryan, and Ryan is a former med school classmate.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have to talk very quickly about what happens next, because he's trying to hit on her. She has no interest. She's not trying to mess with him. She's not trying to engage with him. And he kind of says jokingly, like, I don't know, spit in my coffee. She does. Hands the cup to him. And he drinks it. Now, I don't know why everybody is not talking about this scene. I was turned on. I was confused. I was horrified. I was aroused. I really was into it. And I also feel like, maybe people don't know what to do with it, but it felt like such a clear signal to me that about the intimacies they're going to share and that they have shared. Mm-hmm, and it's kind of written off as this like cheeky, strange, you know, it's supposed to be this insight maybe into how kind of, you know, degaff this woman is. Like, she just has nothing left to give for anybody, like no F's to give for anybody. It's an intimation of just the underbelly that she lives within.
But there's something really important about the introduction to this Ryan character. He has a really crucial plot point in his pocket that he needs to give to Cassie. An old friend from medical school is back in town and is about to get married.
Mm.
And all these guys were in medical school together. Ryan, this guy Al, Cassie, and her best friend Nina. And when they were there at school together, Nina gets raped at a party while she's drunk. And nobody does anything about it. You know, law enforcement doesn't do anything. The school doesn't do anything. It just gets buried. And Nina is so traumatized that she drops out.
Hmm.
And she kills herself. And all of this is what sends Cassie off the deep end herself and on this mission to lure guys in bars in order to shame them. And not to get revenge on any one guy, but on the culture of misogyny that both facilitates these assaults and then helps bury them once they come to light. And I think that what you're supposed to glean from the like scores and scores of completed tallies is that
this is working in some way for her, right? Like, it is a form of cutting. It's a form of bulimia. It is like a kind of self-harm. I think she's trying to fill a hole whose depth she doesn't know. But I also think that to the, like, the way this movie works, it's so tidy that, of course, I mean, I'm believing that this is, in her mind, a successful experiment in,
yes,
in therapy, right? Because the movie itself is so tidy and not a hair is out of place, so to speak, in the way that it operates. The movie is a machine and it is well oiled.
Yeah. I'm thinking on what you said about self-harm. I mean, she's not really able to process in a way that we would consider healthy. She's not able to have any kind of emotional sobriety or healthy intimacy or healthy coping mechanisms, that she's really invested in this interaction of manipulation and power dynamics. But I would also say that I think what we're witnessing is a critique of how little tools there are. We don't equip women with tools. We don't equip people with tools of coping and figuring out how to navigate harm and figuring out where to turn and feeling supported as they try to deal with unspeakable harm, you know? And for me watching it, it's really commentary about a lack of infrastructure and support for women like Cassie and Nina, who are suffering as survivors.
And so Cassie's project changes at this point, because this old med school classmate who's back in town, Al Monroe, he's the guy that's getting married, and he was the guy who also raped Nina. So Cassie goes from targeting these guys in bars, these random strangers, in order to, like, teach them a lesson, to targeting the people involved in Nina's rape and in the cover-up of her rape, including the dean of this medical school, who's played by
Mrs. Coach. FNL forever. Go on.
Yes, Connie Daisy. Britton is the med school dean.
Me. Dean Walker, please sit.
She really has perfected that polished air of indifference of a school administrator who's, like, totally unaware of the actual reality of the environment they're lording over.
Oh, yes, Alexander Monroe. He actually just came back and gave a talk here. Oh, he's a really nice guy, really smart.
The dean is like, oh, that guy Al, he's wonderful. He's a really good guy.
Are you a friend of his?
No.
So you don't remember the accusations made against Al Monroe?
And so Cassie in this moment is bringing up her friend Nina Fisher, and she's asking the dean, do you remember this incident of reported sexual assault where several of these students raped and attacked my friend? And she reported it. And the dean's like, oh my God, well, who presided over that case?
You. You felt there wasn't sufficient evidence. You said it was too much of a he said, she said situation.
Well, you know, we get accusations like this all the time. One or two a week.
We bury these all the time.
Yes, I mean, because what would you have me do?
Ruin a young man's life every time we get an accusation like this?
I mean, this language is really upsetting, because the language privileges the experience of the men over the women.
Right.
Why is there so much support for men like Al Monroe and not any support for Nina Fisher, who actually is dead?
You know, I guess he did the right thing. We have to give these boys the benefit of the doubt. That's why I know you won't mind, but 3 hours ago, I picked your daughter, Amber, up from school and introduced her to the boys who live in that room now.
What?
Once the dean finds out that Cassie has potentially done something horrible to her daughter, the power dynamic totally shifts.
She is really pretty, huh? She looks a lot older than she is.
I don't believe you.
I noticed they had a few bottles of vodka in the room, too, but I'm sure they'll take good care of your daughter. She seemed excited, actually.
So here we're starting to see how much of a sociopath Cassie is, and this is the part I love the most.
This is your favorite scene?
Yeah, because Cassie is going to lay out the way that she's going to enact revenge on the dean, right? Which she's going to use her own flawed logic against her.
She is a young girl.
I wonder if she looks so young to those guys.
And the dean is suddenly frazzled and afraid.
Tell me what fucking room she's in. Now!
And by the way, the music starts to come up. The horror music in this movie, there's two music modes.
It's so good.
Music mode number one is soundtrack, like poppy, mostly pop song soundtrack, and this deep, dark, horror-oriented music.
It's also exposing the way, you know, society considers some people expendable and others not, right? Like the dean is deeply concerned about her daughter, even if she's not super concerned about Cassie or Nina. And she's exposing the thinness of her logic. And it's just so delicious. It's so, you know, I know we don't talk about Quentin Tarantino in this house, but it's so Uma Thurman in the yellow tracksuit showing up with the samurai sword, like whisking the blood off of it, just like ready, just like, no, I'm here. You are going to deal with me.
That's a very interesting person to pick, because the first person that comes to mind for me is any Glenn Close character from the years 1985 to 1988 or 1990.
God. The Rabbit in the Pot, really Fatal Attraction. Is that where you're going to go?
Yes. I mean, this is a high-minded, like, inverse morality play on the kind of vengeance that a person like Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction takes on Michael Douglas, right?
Mm-hmm.
She shows up at Michael Douglas's apartment, talks, like, when he gets home, she's there and talking to his wife, and his daughter's in the house. And
so good.
What you see when Glenn Close enters Michael Douglas's domestic life, his marriage essentially, is we're meant to understand that this woman is falling apart in a way. And what Promising Young Woman does is like an inverse of that, which is we already know this woman has fallen apart. We are watching her build that collapse into a thriller narrative, essentially, mm-hmm. that is entirely mm-hmm. predicated upon getting revenge for her and her friend.
I think what I really find to be so fascinating is that the movie is showing us what happens in a community when you won't acknowledge the violence and you won't acknowledge the harm. And I like thinking about community accountability, right? Like the scene is really about the failure of the institution to protect women. But it also speaks to the ways in which this community in particular did not wrap around these women. You know, since last year, I've become really invested in reading up on restorative justice and transformational justice practices. And one of the organizations that I've been following and paying attention to is the Audre Lorde Project. And they talk so much about how, you know, attention to moments of violence, especially gendered violence, and these ruptures in community that are caused by harm, they have to be healed in collective action. They have to be healed together. And what we're witnessing is someone who's been so ostracized by this event that nobody wants to talk about or take accountability for or even acknowledge. And Cassie has sort of been pushed to the margins of this community and this mm-hmm. society. And what's actually happened is they've committed a kind of social murder. And one of the things that's not talked enough about for survivors of assault and abuse is the social death they experience and the ways in which they become persona non grata, right? Because nobody knows how to deal with this. We're not equipped with the tools. People don't. It makes them feel so uncomfortable. And so they'd rather not deal with it. And people just kind of get excommunicated. They get pushed out even farther.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that's what the movie gets right about how isolating these incidents are. And one of the things I think this movie is really good at capturing is that there are actually many ways to die.
There's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, You are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
So now we're in the third act of the movie, which is not the final act. And now we're getting a sense of just how far Cassie is willing to go to put the final touches, the finishing acts on this revenge fantasy. We see her going into Al Monroe's bachelor party, and he is the guy who sexually assaulted her friend Nina. So I just want to say this again. This is when the movie really takes a turn. It gets really bleak, gets really violent, very disturbing.
And this scene opens with the most funereal version of Britney Spears' Toxic.
I would also classify this as horrorcore. It is so disturbing. It's not a song to dance to. It's a song to disembowel somebody to. It's very, very ominous. She's dressed in a nurse's costume, a white nurse's costume with a thick white tights and these red stiletto heels. And she's wearing this cotton candy colored short wig. She looks like kind of like a juggalo, kind of like Harley Quinn.
She looks like Britney Spears.
Yeah.
She looks like Britney Spears as Harley Quinn.
The tone is really dark. The mood is really stormy. It's very ominous. Nothing good is going to happen in this house.
So she's going to make her entrance into this bachelor party.
Well, the doctor's here.
The door opens. No one questions the arrival of this woman who is presumed to be a stripper, a dancer, a performer of some sort, essentially a sex worker. No one is really questioning why she's there. No one can figure out who hired her. But it's very much ingrained in the culture that this is the type of person who would appear at this party. So they just accept it.
Yeah.
And then I kind of love the scene that follows, which is she takes a bottle of warm vodka, which is its own kind of hell, and puts a pour spigot in it. And then it just shows these men just lining up with their mouths open, and she's just splashing alcohol all over them. And she's also doing her own a little bit of a striptease, but it's kind of more about their raw willingness. And in my mind, just like how disgusting they are. And how much in control she is in this moment.
Is everybody here? I don't want anyone to miss out.
Yeah, all the patients are accounted for, nurse.
I kept trying to remember what imagery wanted to surface and like what this woman, this sexy woman in a nurse costume was reminiscent of for me. And I finally figured it out a few days ago.
Okay.
It is 100% Janine Linda Mulder. Do you remember who that is?
No.
The super, super sexy nurse on the cover of that Blink 182 album, and in that video, What's My Age Again?
Oh,
remember that?
Yes.
Like, talk about generation defining. I mean, that video came out in 1999, and, you know, Janine is also a porn star, and there was something really amazing about seeing this sex worker on MTV in this kind of mainstream embrace. And it felt like, you know, the embodiment of that late 90s, like super pro woman, like super feminist, like pro sex, sex positive, that all of that energy that consumed that decade for me. You know, I think there was an inherent tension between how much women were allowed to actually have agency over their sex and their sexuality and how much hostility there was towards women that embraced their sexuality. And it kind of took that as a prompt to really dump on them. And, you know, there was this conflation by male culture that women who were sexually open and sexually forward and sex positive, frankly, could be mistreated because of that openness of their sexuality. And I feel so much of that in this scene.
Time to go upstairs.
And she takes the bachelor up to the room.
Okay, you guys.
He really doesn't want to go, which is a really, you know, like another reversal where, you know, he's sort of encouraged, he's egged on to go, but really doesn't want to.
So what do I...
Get on the bed.
So she has him get on the bed in this master suite, and she handcuffs him to the headboard. And, you know, it seems playful.
So what's your name?
Candy.
I mean your real name.
Nina. Nina Fisher.
What did you say?
I said my name is Nina Fisher.
And he's like, this is a joke. You got it. I want to get out of here. He's not comfortable.
And then comes the reveal when she's like, he starts to realize, like, something is up. And he starts to call for help. And she's like, all your friends downstairs, they're passed out. And so she's roofied all the guys downstairs with this bottle of, I mean, you know, she is also the toxic element in this house. So it's so full circle to me.
Yeah, again, just utter tidiness.
What do you want, money? You blackmailing me?
I want you to tell me what you did.
So, interestingly, she keeps the costume on for all of this. I mean, but is it a costume? Is it a disguise? I mean, one thing you and I have not talked about, really, because we've compared this movie to so many other types of movies and so many genres, but what this really is a superhero movie, right? This is the story of a regular person who has a horrible thing happen to them, and the expression of that horrible thing in day-to-day life is as this alter ego. It becomes this other personality. And in this case, this person is like an avenger, so to speak. And part of that avenging job is to bring justice to Cassandra and to Nina, her friend. And there are costumes involved. And now here she is at the climax getting her arch enemy, this guy Al Monroe.
Really, don't fucking cry. Tell me what you did.
I didn't do anything wrong, though.
What does he think was right about what he did?
By it too. Okay, I mean, it's every guy's worst nightmare getting accused like that.
Oh my god.
That's not my favorite line in the movie, but the thing is, he's like writhing and kicking and pulling his arms, trying to pull himself loose from the bedpost. Now's her chance.
I wanted to be a doctor my whole life. But lately I've been feeling like I might want to get back into it.
She wants to carve Nina's name onto his body.
Help! Help me!
And as she starts to carve into his leg, he breaks free from the handcuffs and things start to go horribly wrong. And this is the fourth act of the movie. This is the beginning of the fourth act of the movie when you see how far this guy is willing to go to keep his reputation intact, how they view her disposability. And, you know, he puts the pillow over her face and just starts screaming, shut up. And I remember feeling disbelief when I started watching this scene. Like, they're not really gonna kill her, are they? And they do.
You know, the thing about the way the scene ends is that you are watching a complete death.
Right. You know, the most powerful thing and difficult thing about this movie is that, you know, it really gives the amount of time. It actually shows you in a visceral way what it would take to kill someone, right? Like, she's fighting, she won't stop. Like, a lot of our popular culture and entertainment, they don't really deal with the actual violence they're showing. You know, you don't always see blood. You don't always see people just get shot and they fall down, or somebody gets their neck sliced and they fall down, or a woman gets killed and it takes 2 seconds of a 3-hour movie. This movie devotes a significant amount of time to the suffocation of this woman. And I think it's meant to really portray, like, he's not changing his mind. Like, he is intent on obliterating, destroying
this is
body
non-negotiable,
and this person.
Yes.
Yeah, it is a non-negotiable death.
You know, the thing that came to mind while I watched it, and, you know, this is a wild thing to say, Jenna, but, like, I did think about George Floyd. I thought about George Floyd's death. I thought about the video of his death and the way that affected people. And the fact that you were seeing a living person lose his life without interruption, it's just a haunting thing that you never forget.
I think my excitement about this movie cooled with this scene. And I think it's really strange to watch a movie about femicide perpetuate that very same thing. And I found it to be so unsettling. And look, I'm not a filmmaker, but I just think I wonder if the point could have been made another way.
Yeah.
I just don't know that a a piece of activism, right, about gender violence needs to sacrifice a woman to make the point. The satisfaction at different points that I enjoy throughout the movie are completely devoid in this moment and in this decision. There's just no possibility for redemption of this character, Al Monroe. You know, he is so invested in himself and his livelihood and his reputation that he's willing to essentially kill another person to preserve himself and save himself. And he can do it with the knowledge that the culture will support him. The culture will rebound around him. Presumably, he thinks the same thing that kept him from being accountable for Nina's rape is going to keep him from being accountable from this murder.
Yes. And all the stuff that you're saying about Al is realized the next morning.
It was an accident.
I mean, of course it was a fucking accident.
Yeah, of course it was a fucking accident. No one's going to go to jail because no one's ever going to find out.
Al, with the help of his best friend, the best friend is doing all the motivating, and they burn her body. They stand over this pyre, basically, of her burning body. And then this MF goes and gets married. And everybody's there. Ryan even shows up. And during the reception, you hear police sirens and you know they're coming for Al. And Cassie has basically orchestrated this whole thing, all this evidence for the police to find to make sure these dudes would be arrested for what happened to Nina and obviously to her. And just to be sure Ryan knew what she did, she scheduled text messages to him.
Right.
To me, what that felt like was the hand beyond the grave that happens in many a horror movie many a thriller. You know, there's a moment in Fatal Attraction where you think Glenn Close is dead after Michael Douglas chokes her in the bathtub. Then she pops up with the knife and, oh, Ann Archer, Michael Douglas's wife, shoots her. And now she's really dead. And what happens at the end of Promising Young Woman is basically a version of that. It is a hand punching up out of the grave. And we hear the sirens, and we're supposed to know that this is over. The cops are going to take these dudes away and arrest them, and they're all going down.
Right. You hear the siren of the police, and it's supposed to fill the viewers with this relief. I mean, it does. It works. You're like, oh, my God, thank God. Right. I mean, there's one side of me that's like experiencing that relief of, quote, help. And then there's the other part of me that's much larger and much more sentient and aware that's like, the police, what are the police going to do? The police ain't shit. And I was like, well, that's also how you know this movie is made by white people, because I don't know anybody who hears the arrival of police sirens and experiences the feeling of relief. And it works as a movie, but I think as you were saying, as like a morality fable, it's really disappointing because that's just not a solution. And the solution cannot involve carnage and casualties and half-burnt bodies.
Right, yeah.
Who's to say that if these guys go to jail, they won't be able to hire lawyers that get them off? I mean, they are supported and protected by an infrastructure that over and over and over again, even throughout the course of this movie, has shown up and protected them and kept them out of harm's way. So why are we meant to believe now in this the final act of the film that justice has been served?
Well, I mean, I keep coming back to this word tidy, right? We are a culture that really, really likes happy endings. We want to know that we got our money's worth. And the way we know we got it is that we leave the theater not just emotionally happy, but with a sense of closure, with the sense of closure that a movie can provide that most victims of sexual assault never receive, right? Mm. So the other movie that came up while I was watching Promising Young Woman again is Thelma and Louise. That movie is essentially the story of a rape survivor. And she tries to go away for the weekend with her best friend, Thelma. And on the first night of this little mini vacation, Thelma is almost raped. And so Louise, who is the rape survivor, shoots the guy dead, just kills him. And the two of them spend the rest of the movie on the run, but also discover that, you know, being on this journey has kind of transformed them into like these powerful, badass outlaw justice warriors. And that movie too ends in a kind of clash of sirens and free will and this question of what is justice going to look like for the two of us?
Yeah.
Rather than surrender to Harvey Keitel, who is the exponent of the Arkansas State Police or the FBI, they decide, you know what? We had it real good. And whatever we're about to turn around and go surrender ourselves to is going to be a whole hell of a lot worse than driving this Thunderbird off a cliff. And the shot of the car flying into the canyon is freeze framed, and there's a fade to white and the credits roll.
Yes. In Thelma and Louise, there's something really incredible about these two women having gone through this traumatic experience together and deciding how they're going to exit it together. They don't rely on the police. They choose something else. They choose something transformative. And even if that thing ends up being death, which we don't really know, it still feels more like at their hands versus at the hands of the state or any more bad men.
Right.
And Promising Young Woman only assumes the outcome is death and jail. Mm. And, you know, Thelma and Louise is a great movie to bring in as a companion. People should watch that alongside this movie as well. And if they have the stomach for it, watch I May Destroy You, which is Michaela Cole's show that aired on HBO last year as well, about a woman surviving the aftermath of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. Michaela Cole's character was able to start walking towards healing and start walking towards a resolution that did not enact any more violence or harm on her precious body. But I felt like I was watching an artist, and I was watching a very angry young woman figure out more violence is not the answer. And I've become really invested in transformative justice. And there's a great post outlining what TJ is by Mia Mingus, who's a disability justice advocate and a TJ worker, that lays out what it actually means to seek justice while still reducing harm, right? And actually, if you think about it, that's such a radical idea.
Yeah.
So much of American popular culture and film and TV is a fantasy that the police will save us. And this year is one of the years that we really are having a national conversation about how untrue that is for so many of us, including white women. Mm-hmm. I mean, you and I are really trying to take stock of a post-2020 landscape, and we're trying to take stock of a moment in time when we have challenged our assumptions about the world we live in and the institutions, and really aggressively acknowledging that the status quo does not work. And Promising Young Woman still relies on the status quo. Like, there's just no nuance and outcome for these women, for these men. And what we see happening in I May Destroy You is an examination of the conditions that led to that violence. And her active participation in disrupting that cycle shows us an outlet for ending it, right? And in the process, we see an outcome for this very promising young woman that does not involve death. That's our show, friends. Still Processing is produced at the New York Times by Alyssa Dudley.
Our editors are Sarah Saracen and Sasha Weiss.
Marianne Lozano mixes the show.
And special thanks to Lisa Tobin and Wendy Dorr.
Our theme music is by Kindness. It is called World Restart from the album Otherness. And if you want more information about the things we mentioned in this episode, all those links live at nytimes.com/stillprocessing.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.